4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene. I'm Mike Osborne.
And I'm Leslie Chang.
In today's episode, we're going to hear an interview that Leslie here did with Graham Merriweather. He's the director and producer of the documentary film American Meat. Leslie, can you set this up for us?
Yeah, sure. So Graham is a documentary journalist, and his film American Meat is looking at chicken, hog, and cattle production in the U.S.
All forms of meat.
All forms of meat. And it outlines some of the challenges and problems with the ways that we currently grow and distribute meat.
And I think one thing to say about this film right off the bat is that it's pro-farmer. I mean, he didn't show any stock footage of animals being killed in a slaughterhouse. And he makes a real point to go out and actually interview farmers, both conventional and in alternative systems.
Exactly. He actually mentioned to me during our interview that it didn't feel right using that stock footage, that hidden camera sort of stuff, because he really wanted to focus on the farmer's perspective. So we're going to lead off this interview with a clip from the movie where he's talking to two conventional chicken farmers. So let's listen to that clip and then we'll get to the interview.
I've never known anything but agriculture. Cattle, poultry, and hay, and that's been my life, literally. In fact, I'm now sleeping in the same room I was born in 72 years ago. I'm an independent type person. I like being on my own. I like being able to set my own hours. I start work in the morning when it gets daylight enough and I can see. And I'm usually working till dark. So it's certainly not the pay. It's just the independence. It's gratifying to me to know that I'm helping feed the world. That might seem simple-minded, but it does fill a void in my life. That I am helping feed people, that if it wasn't for people like me, you and everybody else would be hungry.
This is Leslie Chang. Today my guest is Graham Merriweather. Graham, welcome to Generation Anthropocene.
Thanks, Leslie.
We get to hear, you know, these two really nice farmers talking about their love for agriculture. They're, you know, hardworking, good people, obviously really dedicated, but they work for an industrial chicken company, which is the system that you're critiquing here. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about that clip a little bit, what it was like to talk to Sam Talley and Johnny Glosson.
Yeah, I mean, that was why I think the most important decision we made in the production of the film was not to put any hidden camera footage in the film, because then that set us off on a journey where we got to talk to people like Sam Talley and people like Johnny Glosson, the people that, for the most part, feed most of our country. And so, I mean, they're truly wonderful, kind people, and they're often stuck in a treadmill of debt. It's very, very sad to see, because what'll happen is, in order to keep their family farm going, they have to sign a contract with a big integrator. And so what they'll do is they'll take out a few $100,000 loan to get some chicken houses or some hog houses or whatever the animal may be. And then they pay that loan off incrementally. And I think Johnny was telling me that he's only making like $17,000 or $18,000 a year on top of what he's paying back. And then 20 years later, when he's paid off that loan, well, guess what? The technology has jumped forward so far that they say, well, you have to buy new houses or you have to retrofit your current houses or else we're going to cancel the contract on you. And so then they have to go right back into the debt that they were in before. So it's a model in which all of the risk is put on the farmers and none of it is put on the large corporations. And it's a model which the farmers are only getting 8 cents on the dollar of what you spend. If you go to Walmart, if you go to the grocery store and you pull a bag of chicken wings out of the freezer and put them in your cart, the farmers only get about 8 cents of that dollar that you spend. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the farmer's market and you buy a whole chicken from a farmer, the farmer's going to get 100 cents on that dollar. And the other thing, too, and it's really important to say this to be fair to the large integrators like Tyson and Purdue and Pilgrim's Pride, is that the reason why the farmers only get 8 cents on the dollar is because those companies are doing a whole heck of a lot of work on everything else. I mean, they're the ones that have the hatcheries that provide the farmers with the chickens. Then they take them. They have the slaughter facilities. Then they have the packaging facilities. Then they have massive marketing departments. So they are doing a much larger percentage of the work. And the reason that the farmer's market is getting 100 cents on the dollar is because they have to do all of those steps. They have to be their own marketer. They have to be their own slaughterer. They have to do everything along those lines. And so it makes sense that the farmers in the conventional systems would get less of the food dollar than the farmers at the farmer's market. With that said, I think most people looking at the current system would agree that farmers, even in the conventional models, would deserve a larger percentage than 8% of the food dollar that gets spent.
Right. So I have another clip, and this one is kind of earlier on in the film. And this segment here is about how much fossil fuels we consume in the production of corn, soy, and meat in the United States, and then all the way through to the distribution of it. So let's hear that clip now.
Pigs eat a lot. Their feed is composed primarily of corn and soybeans. The production of these crops, on a large scale, requires a lot of energy. Energy in the form of fossil fuels. Fred Kirschenman is a farmer and scholar who has been studying agriculture his entire life.
Fertilizers are either made from fossil fuels or mined and processed and shipped to the farm by fossil fuels. Most of our pesticides are products made from fossil fuels. Farm equipment is manufactured with fossil fuels. You have to bring the feed to the animal. You have to truck the manure of the animal out with. Those are all energy-consuming factors.
Like pigs, industrial cattle eat a lot of corn. Unlike pigs, they spend their first 5 months outside on pasture, often in the Great Plains. From there, they're trucked south to feedlots, often in Texas, then to the slaughterhouses, often in Kansas, then to the packaging facilities, often in Oklahoma, then to distribution centers, and finally, to grocery stores and restaurants. In recent decades, our meat industry expanded production and began exporting globally. All this long-distance transportation makes the industry even more dependent on fuel.
I think that clip does a really good job of talking through every single step at which we have to use a lot of fossil fuels for agriculture and meat production. But to my mind, an interesting choice that you made was, I think, you didn't pull from fossil fuels to carbon emissions or to global warming and climate change, and you kind of just cut it off at the fossil fuels part. And so I'm just kind of wondering why it was that you made that choice. I mean, global warming is kind of like a buzzword that might turn people off. So that makes sense to me. And like the phrase sustainable agriculture also never shows up in the film, which I also thought was an interesting choice. So could you just talk about that and kind of what you were hoping to achieve by doing that?
Yeah, I mean, we were very particular in the type of words that we used and the type of tone that we chose throughout the film. And the real reason for that is because, well, A, we didn't want to repeat conversations that had already been had. I mean, one of the reasons why we, aside from the fact that it didn't feel right as a journalist, one of the reasons we didn't put the hidden camera footage in the film is because it's been done ad nauseum. How many times have you seen a documentary and they actually have the same stock footage? You know, I mean, it's the same stuff. So one thing is we want to have different, new and different conversations. So that's one reason. I mean, another reason is that we really wanted to move away from idealism and move towards pragmatism. And so we felt like there's huge implications with greenhouse gases from our meat production. But we want to talk to farmers, and we actually want to talk to conventional farmers with this film, and we have been. We've actually been doing screenings all around the country for FFA chapters and very conventional agricultural communities all throughout the country.
Well, what's FFA?
FFA is actually an acronym that stands for Future Farmers of America.
Okay.
It's a youth organization that has over 500,000 members. It's one of the largest youth organizations in America, and it's incredibly well known in rural America and almost completely unknown in the rest of America. They have chapters all around the country where usually part of high schools, and we've done screenings for those young farmers, often that are sons and daughters of conventional chicken farmers or hog farmers. And so they've been able to see the film and see that there's a different alternative method of doing things, and they can make up their mind if they want to go into that type of agriculture or into conventional agriculture. So as far as why we chose not to put greenhouse gases into the equation when we were talking about oil was because we wanted to approach things on a very pragmatic level. Economics drive things, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. If people's pocketbook starts to hurt, then they change their behaviors, usually. I mean, other things will drive it, but that's a huge part of it. And so one of the things that we wanted to point out is the fact that in 2008, when the price of oil went to $147 a barrel, you saw a massive shift in our current system of meat production. You have Pilgrim's Pride, the largest producer of chicken in America, declare bankruptcy in 2008. You have Smithfield, the largest producer of pork, contract by 20%. And so that's not something that you can argue with on any level. It's fact. And so when you're dealing with fact and you're dealing with economics, then I feel like your argument becomes more steadfast. And it's much, much harder to disagree with someone if what they're talking about is economics.
So most of the film focused on the raising of animals, but you do briefly also cover butchering. And I noticed that the only animals that you really show butchered in the film are chickens, and it's shown in a very humane way. You know, they have the upside down cones, and it seems like a fairly painless process. And then you show Joel Salatin on his farm. They process the chicken, and it all looks like very, very clean. But you didn't show any slaughtering of well-raised pigs or well-raised cows. So was that just something that you weren't able to get footage of, or you felt like maybe that wasn't something you wanted to show in your film?
We actually did get access to a slaughterhouse in Nebraska, and we did film there. But the decision we made was, what you do when you're making a film is you often, well, what we did when making this film is you put together a rough cut of the film. So it's usually a longer version, and then you screen it for test audiences so that they can, you get feedback. And so we screened this footage from the Nebraska slaughterhouse where we were showing cattle being killed and broken down. And it just, you know, a couple people left the room. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like culturally we're not ready for that just because there's been such a disconnect between the farm and the city. Just showing a cow getting killed is a horrifying thing for someone that has lived in their entire life without seeing much more than a mosquito get killed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's something that we're not ready for culturally, is to see that. But I think as this farming movement takes, you know, has more and more momentum, I think more and more people are going to say, well, you know, our grandparents did this for many, many, you know, this has been happening for many, many generations, and it's something that we can see. But I feel like right now, the most that people can sort of ethically and morally like process is seeing a chicken die as opposed to a pig or a cow, which for whatever reason.
Yeah, I guess chickens feel like less close to humans, I think.
Right.
Yeah, like further in the evolutionary chain. Sounds like you're optimistic, like you think it's an overcomable blip.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel so much momentum. I mean, like, there is just so much excitement and so many people that are interested in this new food movement that's happening. People often say, well, it's only happening in New York and California. That's definitely not true. At the farmer's market in Iowa City, you can't walk because there's so many people. It's like there's a rock concert or, you know, something. I mean, like, there is this food movement is just growing, and there's so much excitement, and there's so many young people involved. And often I'll talk to farmers and they say my number one new customer is new mothers. You know, and when I hear that, I think to myself, that's probably the best possible new customer to have in any field, because you've got someone who's creating new customers, and who really cares about the health of what they're feeding.
Right.
So, I mean, I think the movement is just growing by leaps and bounds every day. And I think we're really in the midst of a huge paradigm shift within our nation's agriculture.
I think this film is really inspirational, especially for, like you mentioned earlier, you said you've screened the film to the FFA. So there's a lot of young farmers who you're trying to get this film out to. So what's been their response in general? Do you have a good sense for that? Are they thinking about shifting away from conventional systems that their parents are in and going over to this more Joel Salatin back to the earth type?
Well, we've had a lot of FFA students come up after screenings and say, I had no idea that there, like, so, I mean, in a lot of these places, there's absolutely no knowledge of another system. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that in rural America, almost entirely the farmland is corn and soybean. And then almost entirely the animal agriculture is conventional hog barns, chicken barns, or cattle feed yards. But there's only one system in a lot of the very rural areas. I mean, they're starting to hear about this other system, but when they see the film, they'll come up to me and say, I had no idea that there was this other system. So I think there's a lot of curiosity. And oftentimes, the reason we wanted to reach young farmers and reach FFA chapters is because young people are very open-minded. You know, they haven't yet made a huge capital investment in a hog barn, or they haven't yet made a huge capital investment or an emotional investment in a way of life. And so by reaching them, we're able to hopefully have them start to look at new ways of doing things, and then potentially they'll explore that, you know, a few years down the road when they decide whether or not to continue their family's operation or to try something new.
That actually segues really nicely into the last clip that I have, which is it's toward the end of the film, and the first voice we hear is that of Joel Salatin, the lunatic farmer. And then we hear from three other people who have differing opinions on how many young people are joining the workforce as farmers. So let's cue that up.
We have this idea in our country that in order to be economically sound, you have to sacrifice the environment. And I'm suggesting that the two can actually be synergistic, but what it requires is thinking 180 degrees outside of norm. I hope you're beginning to understand on the scale that we're doing things, there is no reason for a confinement house in the country, in the world, anywhere.
It's a beautiful vision, but there's a catch. If we want to feed America with grass-based farms, we will need about 4 million people to start farming this way.
Small-scale farming, by its nature, requires a lot of people to move out to the farms, and I don't see that happening.
We have a segment, we have a percentage of our population that's wanting to do that, but a mass exodus back to the farm, I just don't see it.
What I'm seeing in the next generation of young people, they realize that their future is going to be challenging. Now, the good news in this is that we now have, for the first time, a new generation of young people that want to farm.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, that clip expresses a few different opinions. But I think the cool part about that is that you guys settled in on this number, 4 million farmers that we will need to feed the U.S. On these sustainable meat practices. So, I mean, it sounds like the limiting factor right now is basically just the number of farmers. So do you think that we'll be able to reach that 4 million at some point in the near future, far future, anytime?
Yeah, it's interesting. Secretary Vilsack, he had a conference where he called for 100,000 or 150,000 new farmers because everyone recognizes this is a problem. And, you know, obviously our calculations were based on specifically farmers to produce all of the chicken, pork, and beef for the country of America, and that would be 4 million in doing it in the way that Polyface Farms does it. So are we going to get to 4 million new farmers? At first, that sounds very, very unlikely. But then if you think a little bit more and you look at how we have 310 million people in America, so 4 million new farmers, that is barely more than a percent of our population. So that's not a huge percentage of our population, first off. Secondly, and probably most importantly, I just feel this again, you know, I feel this shift that's happening. Like, you don't need to like suddenly get into farming and that's what you're doing full time as a job. I think a lot of times right now, a lot of people just want to grow some food of their own or like have some chickens in the backyard and have eggs. And so, you know, even if we have that happen, that's going to really change a lot of things. So I feel like there's a lot of people yearning to get out and work with their hands and do something. And it seems completely ridiculous to think that we'd have this mass exodus of people, you know, out to the land or out into agriculture. And yet every generation, there's a complete shift. You know, like if you talk to our grandparents about the life that they grew up in, or our great grandparents about the life that they grew up in, they would tell you that it was totally different than the life that we're in today. And so there's always going to be a shift that seems completely impossible. And yet after it happens, it seems inevitable. And I feel like we're at a moment right now where the pendulum has swung very far in this direction of, you know, monocropping, mechanizing, that farming is not the answer. Go into town, get a 401k, you know, get a job. And I feel like now the pendulum is starting to swing back and people are starting to say, wait, you know, maybe if I made $45,000 or $50,000 a year instead of $100,000 a year, but I did something that I really loved doing, that I'd rather do that than just take the bottom line being, you know, financial. Because the bottom line is also your health. And right. it's your community and it's your friends and it's what you spend your life doing. And so I feel like there is a shift that's happening. And I think that we may well see, you know, a lot of people get into agriculture in the next 10, 15, 20 years, just because the pendulum swings. And I think we're swinging back towards people being more interested in agriculture and land and doing something with their hands, mm-hmm. and having, you know, a different definition of wealth.
All right. Well, excellent. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And congratulations on the film. It's great.
Thank you.
So I actually interviewed Graham 2 days before the film was screened on campus. And then, apparently, a bunch of protesters showed up at the screening.
Right. So we weren't able to go to the screening, but we heard from a few of our friends that, like, 9 protesters showed up and kind of, like, took over the event. And this is on YouTube now. There's a video clip of all these protesters showing up at the screening.
Right. And, you know, he's been traveling to campuses all across the country showing this documentary. And we heard that this was the very first time that his movie had been protested. So before we released our episode, we wanted to call him up to find out what had happened at the screening and to get his reaction to this protest.
Yeah, hi. Is this Graham?
Yeah, it is.
Hey, Graham. It's Mike Osborne from Generation Anthropocene.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm sitting here with Leslie Chang.
Hey, Leslie. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Graham?
Good. We were in Prosper, Texas, getting ready for our first screening in the state tomorrow. So.
Nice.
Oh, excellent. Well, thanks for making the time to talk. We're dying to know what happened.
What happened was that we started having our panel conversation after the film had finished screening, and a fellow stood up and started talking about his dog, or a dog that was perhaps representative of all animals, and was very passionate about this, and then came up to the front and was further talking about how he believed that the film and the showing of the film on the Stanford campus was the wrong thing to be done, because in his opinion, the raising of animals for meat is immoral. And then, so we thought that perhaps that was, you know, a demonstration that had happened, but then there were about 8 or 9 other people that were in the audience that also had pictures of dogs that did the same thing. And then they came to the front of the auditorium and made it difficult for the event to continue until they left about 10 minutes later, I would say.
Wow. What were you thinking when this was happening?
am I awake? Is there a guy within an inch of my face telling me that I'm a murderer holding up a picture of a dog named Lisa? Like, it was very surreal.
Yeah.
I think that I was really trying to engage them in a conversation, which happened a little bit, although wasn't really, I think, what they were there to do. They were there to make a demonstration about preconceived beliefs that, you know, that weren't to be shifted. And, you know, but I mean, I think it's really just indicative of the separation from the farm, because so many people over the last few generations have moved into the cities and have really no conception of how food production works. And that's not, we're not talking about meat production here. We're talking about growing broccoli or growing soy or growing whatever it is. You know, anytime you eat a meal, a lot of destruction, a lot of death happened to make that meal get to your plate. You're eating vegetables, that's an area that was cleared. The ecosystems there were disrupted. Animals died. And then to grow the actual food, there's all kinds of rodents and pests that you have to keep out, and you do that through killing the animals. And then the manure that is used to grow crops is coming from animal agriculture. If you're, it's just, there's all these cycles that happen on the farm that if you haven't been to a farm and you don't work on a farm, or at least see a farm, you don't understand that death is a part of life. And if the first time you see an animal die is through a video on YouTube, it's a scary thing, and you don't have any way to contextualize it, so you get angry and confused. And I think this increase in veganism and this increase in activism is directly related to the distance that our culture has gotten from farms and from farming. And I don't have any problem with people coming and expressing their opinions. It's just I would hope that people come and express an opinion and have a conversation as opposed to disrupting an event that was all about creating a conversation and making it difficult for a conversation to happen. I'm all for having different perspectives on the panel and in the audience, but there has to be rules and there has to be respect. To their credit, they did decide to leave and then allow us to finish the conversation, which I appreciate.
It sounds like there's some good lessons in there, and that. And I guess I really do admire your willingness to appreciate different perspectives, as well as talk about the tone with which we talk about it, right? I mean, it is about having a discussion, and that was the purpose of the event and the purpose of these screenings, and that does need to be done in a respectful manner.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm confident that we'll continue to have great conversations as we go throughout the country and talk to students and farmers and chefs and professors and all the people that are a part of our food system.
Yeah. All right, Graham, thanks for taking the time to chat with us again.
Yeah, thanks a bunch, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thanks so much for doing the show, and have a good night.
Yeah, good luck with the screen. And good luck with everything.
Thanks Graham. Bye.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene.
We want to thank our guru, Tom Hayden, as well as Maxine Luckett for all their behind-the-scenes work.
Special thanks to Pam Mattson, the Dean of Stanford School of Earth Sciences. And a very special thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths.
We also want to thank KZSU Stanford 90.1, where most but not all of our interviews are recorded.
You can find past episodes on our website, anthropocene.stanford.edu, where you can also submit a story idea of your own.
Follow our conversation on Twitter, @GenAnthropocene, or like us on Facebook.
I'm Mike Osborne.
I'm Miles Traer.
And I'm Leslie Chang.
History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Welcome to our new geologic age.